Few things are bring as great a sense of satisfaction as those occasions when we believe that justice has truly been served. And it's equally true that few things are as disturbing and as disconcerting as injustice that is done to an innocent person. In all of the history of jurisprudence, no legal proceedings stand as such a blatant disregard of justice than do the trials of Jesus Christ. Jesus will be railroaded through some of the most unfair, disorderly, and illegal set of trials in all of religious and civil proceedings. No man was ever more innocent, and therefore no trials were ever more unjust. Following his arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane, the soldiers drag him back across the Kidron Valley and into the city of Jerusalem. And he will no longer be a free man from this point to the end of his life. In the early morning hours, he will be subjected not to just one trial, but a series of six. Three of them will be Jewish and religious in nature. Three of them will be Roman and therefore will be civil in nature. When he stands before the Jews, the charge will be that of blasphemy, a capital offense according to the law of Moses. And yet, since the Jews are lacking the liberty to administer the death sentence, they will be compelled to come to the Romans and get their cooperation if they are to fulfill their heinous mission to do away with Jesus. And yet, in so doing, they will be forced to change the charge from blasphemy, something that the Romans care very little about, to treason, something that the Romans care a great deal about. And it will be, at least in part, this move that will help in the fulfillment of Scripture, that Jesus will not be executed in a Jewish way by stoning, but rather by a Roman means, crucifixion. He will be hung on a tree. Now, the Jewish regulations in regard to the legal proceedings were taken from the law of Moses and interpreted in the Talmud. And yet the original, the earliest written version we have of that dates to about 170 or 200 A.D. And so we can't be sure that all of the practices of the first century matched the standards that are written down later. But certainly many of them would have been consistent with what was expected in Jesus' day. The Talmud instructed that an arrest for a capital crime was to be made in broad daylight and not at night. That it also stated that an arrest for a capital crime was not to be based on information that came from the offender's follower. It was believed that if the accused was a criminal, then so also were his followers. It instructed that no trial was to be held at night, that is from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., and that those trials were to be open to public scrutiny. The defendant was allowed, or at least supposed to be allowed, to bring forth his own witnesses and his own evidence. Also, the trial was never to take place before a single person, but a minimum of three, so that partiality and prejudice could be avoided. And yet, at least one, if not two, of the Jewish trials will take place in front of single individuals. The defendant was to be protected against self-incrimination, and the counsel could not initiate charges against someone, but could only consider charges that had been brought before them by an outside party. According to Jewish law, members of the court, after hearing testimony regarding someone accused of a capital crime, were not permitted to render an immediate verdict. Instead, they were instructed to return to their homes for 2 days and two nights, eating only light meals, drinking only light wines that would provide them also an additional amount of time for more evidence, more testimony to be produced on behalf of the defendant. It was then only after 2 days of further contemplation they were to return once again and once again to hear the testimony against the accused, and only then to cast their vote. The Jewish council, as we'll see here this morning, will give its verdict in just a matter of moments, less than, certainly less than 30 minutes. If after that process had taken place, a guilty verdict was brought and reaffirmed, then the prisoner was to be escorted to the place of execution with a herald going before him that would shout to the crowds that if there could be any evidence produced in favor of the condemned, that it must come forth, and it must come forth quickly. When properly administered, the Jewish system was not only incredibly fair, but it was extremely merciful. And the overriding principle by which the council was to function was not to destroy life, but rather to save life. And yet what we see in the trials of Jesus is that the system will not operate fairly, nor will there even be a hint of mercy extended to Jesus. He is tried without even being charged with a crime. He is tried at night and in private. There is no defense counsel that is permitted, and the witnesses will be bribed to provide false testimony. He will be executed in a matter of just a few hours of sentencing, and therefore the judges who are in charge of the proceedings will never reconsider the verdict. The truth be known that the verdict and the sentence had already been decided long before Jesus was even arrested. And so this morning what I want us to look at is just the first three trials, the trials that would have taken place in a Jewish context and therefore would have been religious in nature. And the first trial actually takes place before a man named Annas here in John chapter 18. By the way, John is the only one of the four gospel writers to provide us with the details of this first trial. And so I hope your Bibles are open. Let's begin chapter 18 and verse 12. So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. Now before we dig into the verses here, let's clarify a somewhat complex and confusing issue involving the Jewish high priest in the first century. We're told that he is brought to Annas first. Annas is distinguished there in verse 13 from Caiaphas, the high priest. But we find later in the text that the high priest, who in the context of verse 19 is clearly Annas, questions him. And then in verse 24, that Annas sends him to Caiaphas, the high priest, in verse 24. Annas actually served as the high priest from 6 AD to 15 AD, and it was at that time that Pilate's predecessor as governor had Annas deposed from the high priesthood. But under Mosaic law, the high priesthood was an appointment for life. It was similar to our Supreme Court appointees. And with the arrival of the Romans and their rule in the land of Palestine, the office really became subject to bribery and corruption. Therefore, the high priesthood was given typically to the most self-seeking priest, the one who would most readily cooperate with the Roman officials. And yet, because of this outside interference, many of the Jews resented the arbitrary and deposing an appointment that took place by this foreign power. And so even though Annas was not the recognized or the official high priest from the standpoint of the Roman officials, he was seen by many of the Jews as actually being the real high priest. Following the deposing of Annas, there would be no fewer than four of his sons who would come to the office of high priest at one point or another. And here we are told that Caiaphas, the official high priest in the eyes of Rome, also has a connection with Annas, that he is Annas' son-in-law. Luke, in his account in chapter 3 and verse 2, tells us that the preaching of John took place in the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. The word of God came to John in Acts 4 and verse 6. Luke there describes, and Annas the high priest was there, and Caiaphas and John and Alexander, and all who were of high priestly descent. As I said, Annas served from 6 to 15 A.D. Caiaphas will serve from 18 to 36 A.D. And in the 3 years that were in between Annas and Caiaphas, four of Annas's sons will serve in that three-year period, and it shows just how quickly those four men fell into disfavor among the Jews. And the fact that Caiaphas lasted for 18 years indicates as well how much he was able to pacify the Jews and, or the Romans and stay in power. Now, with that background in mind, it's easy to see that Annas would be viewed as a sort of an elder statesman for the high priestly family. He was a man who carried a tremendous amount of clout, not just with the Romans, but also with the Jews. And this large amount of influence had, to some extent, been purchased from the Romans. He not only possessed power, but he possessed a tremendous amount of wealth, because in the court of the Gentiles, there had been set up what would become known as the bazaars of Annas. It was here that men would set up their stalls to sell animals to sacrifice. And these alleged merchants, and we'll put air quotes around that, were really nothing more than extortioners. Every animal that was brought for sacrifice had to pass the inspection of the priests, and those that were brought from the outside oftentimes failed that inspection. Annas made sure of that. But there would always be a substitute that was ready, or one that was sure to pass the inspection. It would be provided for a price. And it was an incredibly high price. For example, something that might cost $4 on the outside might cost $75 inside. Annas was also in control of the money changers who were there to exchange foreign currency into the Jewish shekel so that the temple tax could be paid, and again, at an exorbitant rate. And so here's Annas and his family taking advantage of those who have come to worship God, and they, as a result, have amassed a large fortune. Keep in mind that Jesus, on two occasions during his ministry, has run out the sellers and the money changers from the temple, and therefore it's easy to suspect here that Annas had a personal axe to grind with this Galilean preacher. His position of being in a real sense of power behind the high priesthood, combined with this personal distaste of Jesus, is perhaps what led Jesus to be put before him first. He surely would have been one of, at least wanting to be one of the main players in evaluating the case, trying to formulate a charge against this troublemaker. And yet, we'll see that though they go through the motions of a trial, their self-interest has already arrived at a verdict before the trial even begins. John inserts a brief aspect of Peter's denials, you'll notice in verses 15 through 18, before he picks back up with Annas' interrogation of Jesus, beginning in verse 19. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. The high priest here, remember, is referring to Annas. Jesus answered him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple, where all of the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said." When he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, "Is that the way you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me?" So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. There's two lines of thought or questioning in terms of the interrogation. First, in terms of his disciples. And it is seems likely that what he's trying here to do is to ascertain the size of Jesus' following. Jesus will say nothing in this interrogation of his disciples or the number of them. Instead, he will keep quiet about his disciples in keeping with his prayer that he'd already made on their behalf back in chapter 17 and verse 12, that he would lose none of them except Judas. The second line of questioning involved his teaching. Again, remember, the Jews must enlist the help of the Romans, but they have to be able to sell this to the Jewish people. And so they need some kind of charge, some kind of piece of information that would communicate to the Jewish people that Jesus was a threat to their way of life. He's trying to get Jesus to incriminate himself and thus expedite the matter. Again, another illegal aspect, since the Talmud instructed that cases were to rest on the testimony of witnesses and not on the questioning of the defendant. Jesus responds to Annas by telling him that his teaching had always taken place in public, and therefore there would be an abundance of witnesses who could provide evidence of what he taught, whether it was heretical or blasphemous. And by the way, Jesus is not claiming here that he never taught anything in private. He certainly had taught his disciples in that way. But the point that is being made here is that the teaching between the crowds and the disciples was only different in terms of depth, not in terms of content. That Jesus didn't, when he was out in public, just teach benign things when he was around other people, and then when he was in private with his disciples, teach inflammatory or dangerous or heretical things when he was in private with his disciples, that there was not one set of principles that he operated by when it came to public consumption and another set when he was in private with his men. And because of that, there was no need to question him. There was no need even to question about his disciples. Any one of the countless thousands of people who had ever heard him preach and teach could provide testimony in regard to what was the content of his message. And Jesus' question, "Why do you question me?" seems to be an indictment of the legality of their questioning him to begin with. Either way, his question and his statement in verse 21 does not set well with his captors. One of the officers strikes him and rebukes him for his answer, and yet Jesus does not back down. Jesus is not intimidated into making a false admission here. If his response to the high priest was illegal, if it was inappropriate, then there should have been some kind of formal charge lodged before the punishment was meted out. But if he spoke truth, especially if he was challenging a forbidden form of interrogation, then why should he be punished for that? Because the burden of proof ultimately is on them. And it's here, from the very outset, that we see his opponents being unmasked for who they really are. Unable to condemn Jesus by a legal proceeding and a fair trial, they are perfectly content to resort to an illegal and an unjust trial. And John, in his gospel, makes it very clear that this is not about a legal proceeding, not in this truest sense of the word. This is merely a plot to kill Jesus. And John, you'll notice there in verse 14, references what Caiaphas had said earlier in the Gospel of John, back in chapter 11, that it was expedient for a man to die on behalf of the entire nation. The corrupt Annas is no match for the integrity of Jesus. And he realizes that this is going nowhere, and so in verse 24, he sends him bound to Caiaphas. If Jesus, anyway, is to be brought successfully before the Romans, a legal accusation must then come from the one that the Romans recognize as being the legitimate high priest. It's likely that the two residences of Annas and Caiaphas were connected in some way, since John seems to make it clear here that though there is a change in judges, that Peter is able to remain in the same courtyard and to see what was going on in both of those residences. Now, John will tell us nothing about the second and the third Jewish trials. For those accounts, we must go to the Synoptics. So turn, if you would, over to the Gospel of Matthew. And just while you're turning, John, though he doesn't say anything about the second and the third Jewish trials, will provide the greatest amount of detail when it comes to Jesus' arraignment before the Roman governor, Pilate, and the civil aspects of his trial. Here in Matthew chapter 26, notice verse 57 beginning, here we find Jesus before the one that the Romans would have perceived as the acting high priest, a man by the name of Caiaphas. Picking up in verse 57, Matthew chapter 26, verse 57, those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. But Peter was following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest and entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. But now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. They did not find any, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward and said, "This man stated, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" The high priest stood up and said to him, "Do you not answer? What is this that these men are testifying against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God, that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to them, "You have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I will tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his robes, and he said, "He is blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" They answered, "He deserves death." Then they spat in his face and beat him with their fists, and others slapped him, and said, "Prophesy to us, you Christ, who is the one who hit you?" While Annas is carrying out his interrogation, it's likely that Caiaphas is busy trying to put together an illegal gathering of the Jewish council, again, at night, to try a man who at this point in time still has not been indicted of any kind of a crime. Now, Caiaphas, he's not as clever as his father-in-law was, but he was equally devious and corrupt. He, too, despised the truthfulness, the integrity, the righteousness of Jesus because it brought judgment upon his own greed and his own ungodliness. As the ruling member of the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, it was Caiaphas's responsibility to ensure that Jesus had a fair trial, and yet that's the last thing that he is pursuing. He understands that if they are to have any hope of carrying out their plan to convict and to execute Jesus, that they must come up with some kind of a charge. And Matthew reveals the extent to which their hatred went, in that they were quite content to get a conviction that was based on what was knowingly false testimony. Because Jesus is innocent of any wrongdoing, his accusers will have to become the liars. And yet even then, the false witnesses that came forward, they were unable to get corroborating testimony, according to Mark chapter 14 and verse 56. Matthew tells us that finally two men step forward with a charge that in verse 61 appears at least to be usable for them. They don't get the exact wording correct, but Jesus had indeed uttered something similar to what they claimed earlier in his ministry in John 2 in verse 19. And these men have come to the conclusion that what Jesus was saying is that he was going to tear down the actual temple building itself and rebuild it. And yet Mark 14 and verse 59 informs us that not even in that respect was their testimony consistent. By the way, the Talmud said that should testimony or evidence be shown to be inconsistent, that it immediately became inadmissible in any kind of a legitimate hearing. The fact that there was not a single witness who could be found that could convict Jesus of wrongdoing is one of the strongest affirmations of his spiritual and his moral perfection. Because I assure you, if any fault had been found in Jesus, it surely would have come to light at this stage of the trials. The frustration on the part of the high priest begins to rise. He understands the need to get this trial wrapped up, that there is this sense of urgency. And when you read both John's account and Matthew's account, I think there is this legitimate feel of urgency because of the proximity of the Passover Sabbath as well as the seven-day feast of unleavened bread. They understand that they must get this trial wrapped up and get it wrapped up sometime before dawn. Because once the feast day hit, once dawn comes, it would be impossible to crucify an offender because it would infringe on that particular feast. And they would have to wait for another week until they could execute him. Remember that they had planned to wait until after the feast to arrest Jesus. But Judas, what he provided them was some unexpected help that appeared to give Jesus to them on a silver platter. And so if they're to have any chance of getting Jesus executed before the start of the Sabbath day, they must get him tried, they must get him formally condemned no later than early Friday morning that would allow them time to go to Pilate, get his rubber stamp on having Jesus executed in the morning, have him dead and off of the cross by sundown and the start of the high Sabbath that took place at 6 p.m. that Friday evening. And so time-wise, it is a very tight schedule that they're working with. But they are confident they can pull it off so long as they don't get bogged down in things. But they're getting bogged down. Because the testimony that's coming is insufficient and distorted and contradictory, and they understand that that certainly is not going to fly in front of Pilate. And so the high priest begins to press Jesus in an attempt to compel him to incriminate himself. And yet you'll notice in verse 63 that Jesus says nothing. He remains silent. It is the silence of integrity, the silence of innocence, the silence of dignity, the silence of an infinite trust in the plan of his heavenly Father. Caiaphas is further enraged by it. And he continues to badger Jesus, appealing to one of the most sacred oaths that a Jew could utter. He demands that Jesus either deny or he affirm his messiahship and his deity. Again, the hope is that Jesus will make an open claim about who He is so that they could level a charge of blasphemy against Him. Certainly, if they could get Him to admit that He was deity, that would be the height of blasphemy in their minds, and they would be right in every case except for Jesus. Though He had never flaunted His messiahship, His deity, during His ministry, in fact, oftentimes He had told people, don't tell others about this. He had made numerous insinuations to both. And so He gives to Caiaphas an affirmation that Caiaphas was hoping to hear. Jesus references a couple of Old Testament passages, one from Daniel chapter 7 and verse 13, the other Psalm 110 and verse 1. And it is a declaration that they would see Him glorified and that He would be their judge, that one day the accused would become the accuser, that the judges who were now judging Him would themselves be judged by Him. Again, both the verdict and the sentence have already been decided long before Jesus is arrested. All that they need is a charge, and Jesus has just now provided them with one. Caiaphas tears his robe, not out of grief and indignation that God's name had been dishonored, but probably out of joy and relief that Jesus had condemned himself with his own words. The high priest calls for an expression of verbal support to their predetermined conclusion of guilt, and with a unity of voice, they render the unanimous decision he deserves to die. And then in the last couple of verses there in verses 68 and 67 and 68, we find that now even the religious leaders discard the final elements of decorum and decency, and they degenerate themselves into this cruel and crude mob, and they reveal their true depravity. These are the preachers. These are the elders. These are the leading religious men in Judaism. And they take an innocent man and they spit on him and they beat him and they slap him and they taunt him. They've accused him of blasphemy. But they are the real, the true blasphemers. Because they have condemned and humiliated and abused the sinless Son of God. And the irony here is that those men who had so seriously misjudged Jesus would ultimately be judged rightly and fairly by Him. If you'll notice verse 27, or chapter 27 and verse 1, now when morning came, all the chief priests and the elders and the people conferred together against Jesus to put Him to death, and they bound Him and led Him away and delivered Him to Pilate, the governor. Matthew just gives us a couple of verses, Mark also. Look over at the Gospel of Luke. Luke provides us with the greatest amount of detail in regard to this third aspect of Jesus' trial. And that was the official trial, if you will, that took place before the council, the Sanhedrin. This is probably the shortest of the three trials, probably took no more than 20 to 30 minutes at the most. Luke chapter 22, let's pick up our reading in verse 66. There Luke says, when it was day, that the council of the elders of the people assembled both chief priests and scribes, and they led Him away to their council chamber, saying, if You are the Christ, tell us. But He said to them, if I tell you, you will not believe, and if I ask a question, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God. And they all said, are You the Son of God then? And He said to them, yes, I am. Then they said, what further need do we have of testimony? For we have heard it ourselves from His own mouth. Then the whole body of them got up and brought Him before Pilate. It's daybreak. It's after sometime at 6 a.m. or shortly thereafter that a formal meeting of the Sanhedrin is now convened. The ones that had taken place earlier was at before Annas in his residence, before Caiaphas, and some of the priests were there, some of the members of the Sanhedrin, but it took place in his residence. Those as are mentioned in Matthew and Mark, not in Luke, and they took place at night. These take place, this one takes place during the day. This one, it takes place here to provide an air of legitimacy to the trials, that it is legal in their proceedings. And Luke employs a couple of different words here in the Greek. The first one describes the men who made up the Sanhedrin, the council of elders. The second word that he uses seems to designate the place. The official meeting place of the Sanhedrin, and according to the Mishnah, it was in the hall of hewn stones within the temple complex itself. And so what seems to be happening here is that Jesus at some point in time in the morning is transferred from the private residence of Caiaphas to the official chamber of the Sanhedrin. That was where the official trial would take place, where a formal charge and a sentence could be pronounced. So it would be similar to having a trial in the judge's house somewhere and understanding, well, you know what, this really isn't legal. It's not binding. So let's take him to the courthouse. And let's just go ahead and rubber stamp what we've already decided at the courthouse. Where both Matthew and Mark tell us that the interrogation was pressed by Caiaphas alone. In the official trial, you'll notice that there are no false witnesses. They are gone. Jesus is confronted with the united opposition of the entire council, and they press one question. Are you the Christ? And it seems that that question is calculated to be able to provide a political charge against Jesus. If he admits to being the Christ, then they can claim that he's a revolutionary, that he is claiming to be an alternative king to Caesar. But Jesus doesn't give them a direct response. He understands this is not about a fair trial. And so he instead identifies himself as the Son of Man, a figure from Daniel chapter 7. And he claims that he has authority from God and that ultimately he has authority over them. That at this moment in time, he may be the one that is on trial. But one day he ultimately will judge them. They follow that up with an additional question. Are you the Son of God? To which Jesus responds in the affirmative. And it is at that point he provides them with the testimony that they need in their minds to bring about a conviction and his condemnation. What we see is that they have been unable to get any kind of convicting testimony against him. He brings it against himself. That in essence, he becomes the witness that the leadership was looking for, that he's the one who ultimately sends himself to the cross. And of course, his claim was not a lie. His claim was true. He was the Son of Man. He was the Christ. He was the Son of God. Jesus here claims that he has the right to go directly into God's presence and to be seated with him in heaven. Imagine what a Jew would have thought if he claimed that he could go into the Holy of Holies and live there. This is even worse than that. And so they say, we have no further need of any other testimony. Jesus will go to the cross because in this aspect of his trials, he will remain faithful to his true identity. He will stand and speak in the midst of an audience who has already rejected and resisted his claims. He will make no effort to save his life in keeping with what was predicted in Isaiah chapter 53, because to save his life, it would mean that he would have to deny who he really was, that he was the Christ. And so here is Jesus of Nazareth, standing before his accusers, seemingly as a helpless victim. A group of men who are intent on using the processes of justice to suit their own purposes of bringing the most unjust sentence in all of human history. Annas and Caiaphas have been identified for us as the high priest, God's high priest. But as James read from Hebrews chapter 5, what we find here is that Jesus is the true high priest. The trials of Jesus are to an extent our trials. Jesus stood where we should have stood. Had it not been for our sin, Jesus would never have been there in the first place. Understand that that's what Jesus was willing to do, to extend forgiveness to us. That was what Jesus was willing to endure, to provide grace to us. This is the high price of mercy. That the innocent dying for the guilty. The innocent man standing there silent while false accusations are made against him. The Messiah who stands and as he provides true testimony of his identity has that used against him. to bring about his death and his demise. This is Jesus, God's sacrifice, and his sacrifice for us. This morning, do you need to respond to what Jesus did? That really is the power of the gospel. Not a set of laws to be followed. Not a set of rules that are to be enforced. The power of the gospel is in the message of Jesus dying for us, enduring the humiliation and the agony and the anguish, not just of the cross, but the humiliation of standing before men whom he had created and having them spit on him and slap him. Religious men. Men who should have known better. Men who knew the law, but it wasn't in their hearts. Respond to that this morning. Become a child of God because of you're motivated and compelled by what Jesus has done to make you right with him. If we can help you, won't you obey the gospel of Jesus this morning? No better time than now. Come, while together we stand and together we sing.